She was sitting, half-naked, astride a chair in front of the dressing table, gazing across the back of the chair into the triple mirror. Her bare arms were folded along the tall back of the chair, and her chin was resting on her arms. Her spine was arched, and there was arrogance in the set of her head and shoulders. The black string of her brassiere across the naked back, the tight black lace pants, and the splay of her legs whipped at Bond's senses. The girl raised her eyes from looking at her face and inspected him in the mirror, briefly and coolly. "I guess you're the new help."
Welcome to the James Bond Complex. I'm Matt.
I'm Edgar.
Hey, Edgar, what book are we doing?
Well, this afternoon we are doing the fourth Ian Fleming novel, Diamonds Are Forever.
Forever, 1956.
Absolutely.
So I guess I'll start with my resume. I tried to be as concise and make it as simple as possible, so I might be skipping a few beats, but we'll discuss the book as we go along, and if people have more questions, there's always Wikipedia, and we can read the damn book also.
That's true, because we do spoil the hell out of these books. We're going to spoil it. It's one of those things where I don't think any of the listeners care that we spoiled the films. If they're listening to the show, I'm pretty sure they've seen the movies, but when it comes to the books, obviously, spoilers, you know, in all caps.
Yeah, we're going to spoil this thing rotten. It's 1956. The English diamond trade has been losing £2 million worth of diamonds in the last few years. James Bond is sent to investigate the smuggling operation. 007's investigation puts him in contact with the charming Tiffany Case, a woman working for the Spang brothers, Jack and Serafino Spang, the mobsters in charge of the illicit traffic and the heads of the so-called Spangled Mob. Bond travels across America, encounters his old ally, Felix Leiter, in Saratoga, and then finally ends up in Las Vegas, where he's beaten to a pulp chase across the desert by Serafino Spang. But thanks to the help of Tiffany, Bond kills Serafino and learns that the second brother, Jack, is at the other end of the smuggling pipeline under a series of multiple aliases. Surviving a final assassination attempt on their lives from Gay Hitman, Winton Kidd, 007 heads to South Africa and closes the diamond smuggling operation by killing the last Spang brother, Jack. And thus ends Diamonds Are Forever, 1956. Thank you very much.
I remember our very first episode, our Phantom Menace, if you will, which was recorded a few months ago at this point.
Yes. Oh, and we should mention also, now I'm thinking, this is the first episode that's being produced after the podcast is launched. So hopefully this sounds much better than the previous episode.
Hopefully, and now there's a bit of a sense of official history, because we tend to record about once a month. We usually, you can't take a month off because you have to read the book and watch the movie and this and that. But so to speak, we take about a month off and then we do three back-to-back episodes. This is the first time, in fact, where there is actual material out there. We've received a little bit of feedback.
Greatly appreciated, by the way.
Thank you very much to the listeners. So it's kind of fun. It feels like we've actually found our wings right now. We're no longer saying, visit the website, email us, when like nothing is out there. Now we're actually recording and stuff is out there. So that's a lot of fun. Going back to our maiden episode where we introduced our love for Bond and explained it and where we're coming from, I remember I don't remember what I said, but I seem to recall you saying you are not, and maybe you're still not, the biggest Diamonds Are Forever novel fan. Does that still hold true?
I'll keep my final word for the end of the podcast, but my...
One chance.
I'll ask the question. Is the book better than the movie or the movie better than the book? I'll ask the question. We can answer it as we go along through those two podcasts, and I guess have a final say on our opinions of both the book and the movie, where they belong. Are they recommendable, or should people maybe not put too much attention to these efforts by Fleming and the Broccoli and Saltzman.
Harry Saltzman, yeah.
He was still involved.
He was still there. His last one is Golden Gun.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll keep our final summation for a little bit later, but I think if you look at the reaction at the time, it was not the best received of his novel. So I tend to agree that it's a lesser effort.
Unfortunately, I am going to agree as well. This is the fourth book we're reading for this podcast. It's been great so far. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy myself this past week, because I tend to read these things kind of last minute. I usually, on the day we're recording, I finish the book like 2 or 3 days earlier. I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy myself, but this was the first time in 4 books where there were passages where I was kind of bored and I wasn't really into it. And it had a lot to do with the gangsters, Saratoga. Everything in Saratoga, I could not care less. It wasn't interesting. Like Bond, and apparently Fleming, don't care about horses, don't care about mud baths.
I think we should start discussing the book beat by beat.
Beat it.
And we'll start with the first chapter where nothing happens, basically. A scorpion gets killed.
It's an interesting way to start the novel from the perspective of a scorpion, you know, a killer, if you will. What's more, it's my understanding that the two characters, or at least the character that kills the scorpion, is presumably a Caucasian. I don't see why it wouldn't be a Caucasian. And he kills the scorpion and says, "Oh, the black bastard." And it's taking place in Sierra Leone. So, like, I guess there's a little bit of commentary there, perhaps. I don't know what Fleming is doing. Oh. It's curious because we don't see those characters again until
the very end.
The very end. I understand the bookends. It's an interesting idea. I just don't think Fleming really brought it to fruition as much as he normally does when he describes stuff and explains things.
It's a travel loggy book, I guess. I tried and I failed. And honestly, I tried to read The Diamond Smugglers. It's a book he wrote, I guess, before or around the time he actually did this novel, but he wrote it after. There was some confusion on my part. I thought it's a book that he wrote before Diamonds Are Forever and then used the material, the research material for Diamonds Are Forever. Apparently, it's probably more the other way around. But he was certainly fascinated with the diamond smuggling operations happening at the time.
I'm looking at my copy of James Bond, The Man and His Word. Just before you arrived, I flipped through a few pages. I think Diamond Smugglers is 57.
Yes, it is.
And this is 56. Yes. So yeah, it would have been, yeah.
I was mistaken. I bought it on Kindle, so I didn't pay much. But as soon as I realized, oh, it came up the year after. So I stopped reading. I was like, it's not. No, but it's.
Who cares?
It's not. It didn't influence this book. It probably that book is probably more influenced by Diamonds Are Forever. So I didn't use it for research material when I realized that. I was like, you know what? I'm going to concentrate my research and my investigation elsewhere. And then
Lord knows I'm not going to help you with the research.
Yeah, I know.
That's been established quite clearly right now. Although I couldn't imagine maybe the Diamond Smugglers. I can't seem to say that word today. It could be maybe an interesting companion piece. After reading Diamonds Are Forever. I have not started it.
The book Diamonds Are Forever didn't inspire me to read The Diamond Smuggler. And I don't think The Diamond Smugglers is probably that interesting, because it refers to crimes that are now probably 70 years old. So it's almost pointless to investigate. I don't know. To me, it's meh. The world has changed since then, so it's...
True. Back to the book at hand. So somebody kills a scorpion.
Yes.
There's a brief conversation between a helicopter pilot and... I think the gentleman's a dentist. I think he's a dentist. Which is, in a very roundabout way, how they're actually partially smuggling these diamonds out of Africa. After that, as often is the case in these Bond novels, the second chapter is an M scene. It was funny reading the book this time. It wasn't that long ago that we reviewed Live and Let Die, and the second chapter is an M chapter, and it pertains to Bloody Morgan's Pot of Gold, if you will. This time, well, there are no pirates involved, but nevertheless, it is yet another fairly extensive, lengthy conversation about a beautiful, brilliant, and much coveted
commodity.
Exactly. This time, it's diamonds, and it's a funny thing. I don't dislike diamonds. I think my big problem is I just don't care about diamonds.
It's a known fact that our generation doesn't care about diamonds, and
that is a fact.
That is a fact, because people don't get married, and most people don't have that fascination. And apparently, the diamond industry is really worried about people like you and I, because we don't care about diamonds. Apparently, it's not.
They're very pretty.
They're very pretty, but do I wear rings? Do I know anyone who wears rings with diamonds in them? That's maybe for weddings, but even then, people our generation tend to elope more than a big wedding, and they often, if they do, they get trinkets. It's not really it's not really a thing anymore. Diamonds, our generation is kind of detaching itself from.
I think the point is fair, and it's unfortunate, you know, to say that I wasn't particularly engaged with this passage of the book because I don't care about diamonds, but. That's what I was feeling.
Come on, Edgar. It's data dumping. It's a boring chapter. It's like, oh, this amount of diamond is blah, blah, blah. Oh, it makes this much of amount, blah, 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 blah. Ugh.
I think that's
it's boring.
That is the, those are the journalistic instincts of Ian Fleming showing. He loves details, and good for him. He was a journalist, apart from being a novelist. So he obviously likes details. He likes collecting facts. He was a very curious man. He was very curious about the world, be it commodities or cultures or languages and what have you. So that's, I can appreciate the fact that that's shining through in the chapter. But like you said, it is kind of boring.
As someone who loves doing the research and kind of reverse engineer the book, see where he takes his inspiration, sometimes it's boring. I did not hate the Saratoga part as much as you did. I actually liked some parts. We'll get there when we get there, but that's actually something I noticed about the book itself. There's a lot of it's very travel-loggy. It's very like, I'm like, oh, this place actually exists still to this day. Oh, I can actually go to that restaurant. Oh, that's nice.
But we, it wasn't that long ago that we talked about Live and Let Die, the book, and if memory serves, that was kind of our conclusion about that book. It was very travelogue-y. So I think it, I mean, it, if you want to use that argument as to why you don't like it too much, that's fine by me. That's not why the subject matter doesn't particularly interest me. And there is something else that we'll get to pretty soon, probably. I just don't think it lives up to what Fleming can do.
I'm trying to be as positive as I can. The travel, I'm not saying that the travel logginess of the book is a negative. It is there, but there are things that really don't capture my imagination in this book. And I enjoyed the mud bath. I enjoyed the restaurant references. Actually, for me, things get real, 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 real boring when we get to Vegas.
Where I actually start. My interest is peaked. It's weird how we reacted so differently to this book.
I wish the book was actually worse than it is. To me, it's either good or bad. When you're in the middle, that's where I have a problem with you. And this book is in the middle. I don't feel very warm about it, or I don't feel like bashing it and burning it. I just feel like, just leave it in a dust and where it belongs.
Let it collect dust in the library.
I'm trying to be as positive as I can, but it's hard. So we're going to skip the M scenes.
But the next scene, we start to get to the other thing. I'm not a big fan in this book. There's a scene in which Bond works very briefly with someone from, I can't remember if it's Scotland Yard or some sort of department.
He's a character we met in Moonraker.
Yeah, or who was mentioned in Valence, something like that. And they go to the London office of this diamond company where that may or may not be having a hand in the smuggling operation. And that's where we meet, spoilers, the individual who will eventually be revealed to be the head honcho of this whole thing.
Jack Sprang.
Jack Sprang, or Spang Sprang. I can't remember the name. On the topic of boring, and apologies to Diamonds Are Forever novel fans, I'm really not being very positive now. On the topic of boring, are the villains. It's very strange reading this book. Fleming is extraordinary in his descriptions of places and tastes and sounds and of people, their physicality, yeah, what they're wearing. And on that level, he's doing a good job. I don't think Fleming is writing poorly as far as the descriptions go. What didn't inspire me were the villains. I think Fleming probably watched some movies, did his research, as he is wont to do, hats off to him, and maybe realized, oh, wow, the gangsters from the movies, in the United States, obviously, wow, they are kind of like that in real life. Maybe that was the conclusion he drew. So he creates this cast of characters, some names which will actually come back in other forms in the movie that we'll talk about soon. He creates this cast of characters. They all have funny names. They're all very, very Italiano-American gangstery. And I just couldn't really buy into this world. I felt I was always at arm's length just because it was such a un-Bondian type of story to be reading. And I did have trouble really caring at all about... caring is not the right word because they're the bad guys. You're not supposed to care about them, but I wasn't invested in what they wanted to do.
They're not scary. They're very, very boring villains. But doing my research, there's a lot... If it's not... it's a big coincidence. There's a movie that came out a few years ago with Tom Hardy called Legend. It's about two gangster brothers in London.
Mm. Twins, right?
Twins. Mm. That book was written by the same gentleman who wrote the James Bond autobiography and the, I don't remember the title, but Ian Fleming biography. And these two gangsters really, they remind me both of Wynton Kidd and Serafino and Jack Spang. So I don't know. It could be pure coincidence, because from the information I got, they were more... I don't know if Fleming... Because that book was written probably in 1955. I don't know how big these gangsters were, but it's possible. I was trying to find links, but it's just the notion that the guy who wrote the Fleming biography wrote a novel about these guys, and they have a lot of things in common. One of the two brothers was actually gay, and very daft and very violent, a real psychopath. So he reminded me of Serafino Spang, and also a little bit of Wynton Kidd in that character. I tried to watch the movie. I tried to watch the documentary, but honestly, Tom Hardy and his funny voices, eventually they start bugging me.
I have trouble getting interested or finding these villains interesting. Even Wynton Kidd, who we'll talk about a lot when we do the movie. At least I think we'll be talking about them a lot. Like so many villains in this book, they'll show up for a couple chapters, then you'll never hear from them again. And I think for whatever reason, that didn't hurt the aura that Mr. Big projected in Live and Let Die. I actually think it kind of hurts the aura that the Spang brothers supposedly project in Diamonds Are Forever. I just didn't care about these guys.
They're not scary. And even Bond, the entire book, he's always commenting that this assignment is beneath them. Even the end of the book, M excused himself to Bond. Yeah, this was not a good assignment for you. You kind of wasted your time. And you feel like you're wasting your time when you're reading it. You're like, okay, stop saying that. Make the villain credible. When you see Serafino for the first time, he's getting his nails, his nose hairs plucked. Like, that's not how you introduce the villain.
I know.
Like, when I read that part, I'm like, really?
I think, again, we don't know what Fleming was thinking. We can only do research or hypothesize, but I feel coming off Le Chiffre, coming off Mr. Big, coming off our favorite, Drax. Hugo Drax, I wonder, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I wonder if Fleming was saying to himself, you know what, I've created three like really unique, spectacular villains, two of which are, you know, completely bonkers and are on top of everything. I'm going to try to do that, but almost through a subtler way. I'm going to do it by presenting characters that you don't think are intimidating, but they're actually very well organized. They operate an extremely well-oiled machine, which, I mean, in fairness, they do. I mean, they do eventually get to Bond. In fairness, they do. Valiant idea, bold idea. I just don't think the end result is very interesting. Yeah. That's the problem. But I can, if that was Fleming's intent, I can respect the challenge he gave to himself to make villains as evil and vile as Drax and Mr. Big, but make them like these schmuck Dalian gangsters. Like, okay, I see what you're trying to do. I don't think you pulled it off as well as you could.
Also, it's you're coming off Moonraker, which is a crazy story with a crazy villain and an insane plot. You get the sure eye from that book, and then you follow that book with a gangster movie. Like, it's really, and honestly, at first I'm like, okay, it's kind of like License to Kill, the movie, because he's working his way through the pipeline, he's kind of trying to infiltrate. So I was trying to, okay, it's License to Kill, I'm trying to imagine Timothy Dalton, and so I'm like, I'm really like, I'm trying to see as this greedy Bond, but they don't scare me. Like, no. Bond is not impressed, and thereby I'm not, like, he never has this moment, I was not prepared. No, he's always preparing. Even when he's caught off guard, he's planning, okay, I'm going to do this, blah, 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 blah. He has multiple ways out, and he never feels like he's in mortal danger.
No, exactly, except at the very end when he's in at Spectreville, of all places, and they finally reveal that they know exactly who he is. There's a brief passage where he's sort of like, oh, crap. This might not end well.
Yeah, but they also expose themselves, which is...
That's true. Why do they kill him? I'll never understand.
No, well, we went a little bit ahead.
Speaking of going in chronological order of the story, we can backtrack because there's something we... pretty important part of this book, which we haven't broached yet, and that's the Bond, the leading lady.
Tiffany Case.
I'm going to be a little bit more positive this time around. I've been thinking long and hard the last few days about Tiffany Case, who she is, her backstory, her description, her interpretation as the novel goes along. And the conclusion I've arrived at is I don't necessarily love her character. I can't make myself say I love her character, but I think she's probably the more intriguing and interesting of the characters because of where she comes from, what her backstory is, and how she reacts. She's not reserved. She has spunk. She has gumption. But she definitely holds back from opening herself to Bond. But there'll be these flashes, these glimpses that suggest she's actually quite nice if she allows herself to be nice. But there's a very particular reason, a rather brutal reason, why she does not allow herself to open up. So again, I thought she was very, very interesting, even though... I don't say she's not my favorite. I mean, Helga Brand from Moonraker is still my favorite, but I
Galabrand.
Excuse me. So sorry, but I certainly didn't mind her at all. I can understand why Bond, and this is, you know, it's written in the 50s by a dude, so you know there's going to be that sort of tint to it. But I can sort of understand where Bond's coming from. Well, she seems actually nice in those 2 seconds where she like looks at me differently. And wow, man, she's had a terrible life. She's sort of blocking herself off. Like, as the dude in the story, I can sort of see why he might be falling for her because he thinks he can rescue her. Like, yeah. I understand why that's happening. And that's maybe why I think she's an interesting character. But I've been hogging the mic here. What do you think of Tiffany Case?
A similar feeling, but I was trying to move her away in my head, away from the movie version, because she's a complete different character. We'll discuss it on the other episode. Who I was picturing is probably someone closer to Rizzo from Grease or Margot Kidder as Loisin, like those 70s ballsy chicks that that have an attitude. So I that's who I was trying to sort of taint my vision. To be honest, I didn't. She's not my favorite. Still, Galbraith is still on top. She's probably second.
Galbraith is on top. So that's how you roll.
That's how I roll. she's the most, probably the most modern of the. Because Galbraith, I love her dearly, but she's a trained policewoman. She has training. She knows how to take care of herself. She's not like a solitaire woman that's caught in a bad situation and has to make way. And that's who she is. That's Tiffany Cage. She's in a bad situation, and she's able to take care of herself. And she even takes care of Bond, which is something that I see. I think we see a lot more in the movies and a few times again in the books, is the leading lady, the romantic interest, becoming kind of like a sidekick to James Bond, which it's 1956. That's pretty modern. Like, people kind of have a tendency to, and we have also, we're guilty of that. We always say that, oh, Fleming, misogynist, but no, in fairness, he is, but he's also able to write characters that are not in his purview, don't share his point of view. And she is a lot more capable than her cinematic counterpart, and she's a lot more. Not competent, but more
well. She's resourceful. In between. She's resourceful. She's the in between. She's not a Galbraith, but she's not a solitaire.
And she's not.
She knows how to hustle.
A Vesper Lynn.
She's not a Vesper Lynn. That's true. You know, she knows how to hustle. She knows how to do her job. She's accepted what she does. She knows what she's doing. She's not an idiot. But at the same time, she's also surrounded by people who would kill her in an instant. You know, if she crosses them. So, and that's where Bond comes in to maybe help her out. So I think that's why I found her interesting. But you seem to desperately want to say something now.
Yes, yes. I wrote that excerpt down because I'm still puzzled by it. I'd ask people at work, as my friends, and I need to ask you, because there's a part of the early part of the novel where they go through her papers and information, and her passport detail says, American citizen, 27, born San Francisco, blonde, blue eyes, height, 5'6", profession, single woman. Is it me? That sounds like a hooker. That sounds like a prostitute. Like, I was puzzled.
Well, she did work.
No, she never worked as their mother was but it's impossible for that character to be a prostitute. So I don't know what this means. But I asked a friend of mine at work, and he's French, Français de France, and I was telling him about that. I was like, oh, and he said he worked in customer service in France, and he said, oh, it's probably like the wife of a doctor, apparently. Apparently, when people ask, he had to call a client, and he spoke to his wife, and he asked the client her profession. She said, oh, femme de docteur, doctor's wife. That's not a profession. But apparently, it's some people, I don't know, I think.
On n'est pas en France, is it?
I was puzzled by it, but it amused me, but it also perplex me.
Doesn't necessarily answer the question.
There's no answer. If somebody can tell me what in 1956 a single woman meant as a profession, please tell me.
We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. You want to show us like a 10-second like story video on Instagram? Do it. Go ahead. All means. So no, I guess to close off the conversation on Tiffany Case, I did want to know where Fleming was headed with this character. I did genuinely want to know. Did I find it a little bit odd that near the end of the book, Bond is contemplating the rest of his life with her, given that he was doing that 3 books ago with Vesper Lynd? But at least this time, we've actually gotten to know the leading lady a little bit more. And she is kind of interesting. So I do like Tiffany Case.
I like her, but I don't see. She's not the Bond. Bond is not the man of her life. And she's not, like, obviously, it's not going to work.
No, I think that's the very patriarchal. I'm not sure what the correct term is, but it's a very the manly thing to do. Mm-hmm. Well, this poor woman who actually is nice when she allows herself to be nice. She's drop dead gorgeous by Fleming's description. You know, I kind of want to help her out, and I think I have feelings for her. We'll see where this goes. But I agree. A guy like James Bond and a woman like Tiffany Case, that's not lasting any long. We'll find out in From Russia with Love if they're still together. Spoilers.
Spoiler. I love that he goes to the 21 Club. I've never been, and apparently you still have to bring a jacket. You can't go in like a t-shirt and jeans. You have to dress. If you don't have one, they'll lend you one. It's like, okay.
Apparently. Really?
But it looks, and when I saw it, I'm like, really? That's a, like a fancy schmancy. It looks like 1980s La Cage aux Sports, which is a sports bar in Quebec. A
football helmet hanging from the ceiling there.
I'm like,
what the heck is this?
That's 21 Club. It's a fancy schmancy.
The one in New York, right?
Yes.
This is terrible. I'm not.
next time I go, I'll try and get a reservation or something. I really want to go. I'm curious.
Mission report by James Bond Complex, 21 Club in New York City. Oh, speaking of boring. Oh, my God.
Ode to boring, the Diamonds Are Forever review.
The chapter near the end on the cruise ship where they're playing like a steamship line bingo, like how far are we going to, or how many knots are we going to travel tomorrow given the temperature? Why are we spending 5 pages on this?
I was so bored. I didn't
just
understand it.
So Mr. Winton Kidd could show up and do this absolutely insane bet based on how tranquil the weather is. But of course, Mr. Winton Kidd will try to kill Tiffany, which will slow the boat down. So they'll have won their bet. It's like, why did we take 5 pages to explain this? But it's like the diamond chapter. It's like the sulfur mud bath chapter, which is a very like lengthy explanation.
I like that part because it's a little bit horrific what happens to the jockey. Because what happens is that, we should go through the details, Bond infiltrates the smuggling ring as Peter Franks, and eventually he reveals that his real name is James Bond, and he's supposed to bet a money.
Well, he's helped Tiffany smuggle the diamonds into the United States. He said, well, where's my money? He probably doesn't talk like that, but I
where's
do.
My money?
Where's my money? They give him 1,000 of his 5 grand and say, well, we're not going to pay you now for whatever stupid reason. We're going to send you to Saratoga, and you're going to bet on a horse and win, and that's how you'll get the rest of your money. So that's why he's in Saratoga watching this horse race and betting on a horse race, which eventually leads to, well, there's Felix and him
bribe the
exactly.
jockey.
They do like a counterplay. The play here is Bond is going to earn the rest of his salary on betting on a horse. Behind the scenes, he and Leiter are doing like this, not a counter bet, but they're going to counter the fixing of the race essentially. So
and Bond is sent to pay
the jockey.
Jockey at a mud bat, and Winton Kidd show up. And the entire time they're wearing masks, they sort of build a mystery about them, but
there's nothing special about them.
There's nothing special about
them. We do meet them earlier in the airport, only we don't know that it's Mr. Winton Kidd at that point.
Yeah. But the part where they burn with the boiling mud, the jockey, is a little bit horrific. Mm. And initially I thought that the guy was dead for sure, but no, he's still alive. He's going to be disfigured, but
what's up with this spang? Man, you got to get rid of somebody. Get rid of him. Why are you putting hot mud but not killing? Why are you putting on cleats and dancing on a body but not killing? Why are you doing it? Kill these people if you don't need them.
You're supposed to be.
Did you not see the movie? Kill them.
Yeah. No, it's they're like I said, the villains really underwhelming because they don't kill anyone. I'm sorry, but if you're a fan of this book, I'm sorry about it. I disagree. So he goes to Vegas. He bets again because he failed his first payment attempt by illegally like gambling and getting
right. Well, the Spangs don't know that he's played them. Yeah. So to finally earn the rest of his money for smuggling the diamonds into America, they say, okay, this time go to Vegas, go to this casino, go play this particular game at this particular hour, and we'll deal you favorable cards. But don't play after that. They make it very clear they don't want him to play after
and
that.
And he does.
Because he's Bond. This is actually part of why I like the Vegas section. I find this is where Bond kind of behaves like he does in the film. You know, the joke about James Bond in the movie is that, well, he's the worst spy ever. He's blowing stuff up. He's telling the villains who he is. But he does that to, he's a bit of a shit disturber to get things moving faster. And I do like the fact that he does that yeah. in the Las Vegas passage. Like, well, if I don't start shaking the tree, no apples and peaches are going to fall out.
But
so
that's
I'm
late play. in the chapter in
but
Vegas.
At least it's something.
Yeah, it's something. Because there's a travel log part where, oh, this part was, oh, this gangster owned this thing and blah, blah, blah. It's really boring. I'm sorry, but it's...
Yeah, he makes a little friend there, Ernie Cuneo or whatever his name is. Like
it's based on one of Fleming's friends, apparently.
Yeah, I where the James Bond in his world book was... I did not know that. It was like literally just before you showed up that I was like, oh, that's interesting. That was a real person. But again, at least Bond is taking the initiative to a certain degree, whereas I don't feel he's taking much of the initiative during the earlier parts of the film, which is maybe why I appreciate the Las Vegas section yeah. a little bit more. There's the car chase, which is kind of a cool car chase. They're shooting at each other. It's all right.
Yeah, it's functional.
And then we finally get to the most interestingly named town, Spectreville, which will certainly come into to play in a completely different way some books down the road.
In name only.
But I also like this passage of the book. Yeah. I think it's kind of funky. There's even a moment in this passage, I believe it's when they're going to go on his train, where Bond is in awe. Like, this is what it's like to be filthy rich, when you can do things like that. And I like that recognition from Bond as to the power and the aura one can exude when one is extraordinarily wealthy. So I do like that passage of the book. Matthew?
Yeah.
The ball is in your camp. You may say no. You don't have to agree with me.
Honestly, I'm glad we're at... When I was reading it, I was like, oh, I'm glad it's almost over.
I don't know. Again, it's... I think the book gets better as it goes along. It never gets great, though, but at least it gets better as it goes along.
Valleys with bumps and...
Well, would you say... How would you consider... the moment when Bond saves Tiffany from Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd in the boat. Is that a valley or is that a peak?
That's a peak.
That is a peak. That's kind of cool.
That's cool, actually. That's probably... there's a lot of deviation in that book where you're like, okay, can you just focus on one thing and stop? It needed some editing and a rewrite. Because there's good stuff. You need to improve the villains. Make
needed
them
more
kill
more of
people.
Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd,
and also make them killers, because they like at one point when after the car chase they capture Bond, and I was certain the way I read it I interpreted that they killed Ernie.
They don't. I
they
know.
Don't. I'm like
nobody dies in this book.
No, nobody dies except the villain. So it's again, and even everyone's saying, oh, these it's not worth our time. And at the end of the novel, you agree with them. It was not worth your time. I'm sorry.
I think what's important to put into context. Now, this doesn't mean the book should be getting more praise than we've been awarding it. But hear me out. I think it's important to remember that Ian Fleming wrote these every single year in the span of a couple of months. The fact that Casino Royale, Live and Let Die, and Moonraker are as good as they are.
You're right.
Given the speed, the expediency with
You're
which
right.
you wrote them, not every
I'm
one
not,
of these.
I'm not angry at the book or at Fleming or anyone. It's just like, sometimes you have a lot of home runs and sometimes you just miss the ball.
Right, yeah, it's not strike out. I would call this, you know what this is? This is a really good hit that's deep in the outfield. The ball bounces. You're not going to stay at first. Go for second. But he's caught out at second. You know, you're like, it was a good hit. The running was okay, but you're out at second. That's kind of what Diamonds refers. Not a bad hit. And the idea was there, but you're still out. You know,
that's a fair assessment.
For all you baseball fans out there.
This is who I was picturing as Wint and Kidd.
Oh, who are these jokesters?
You don't know them? I figured you might not.
Was like Abbott and Costello?
No, that's Laurie and Hardy.
Oh, I don't know them as well as Abbott and Costello.
Well, Abbott and Costello are like, they're proto Abbott and Costello. It's like the fat guy, kind of like you and me, the fat guy and the tiny guy.
I go to the gym a couple times a week. Don't call me tiny.
Oh, you're, okay. Well, I'm taller than you. I loved, I kind of like the chase with the train chase.
I was hoping we were going to talk about that. Why do you like it?
Reminds me of Back to the Future 3, if you, I'm going to be honest.
Part 3?
Yeah, with the train and choo-choo.
Oh my, I haven't seen that one in a while. It's my least favorite of the three.
I saw all three of them in theater 2 years ago for the 30th anniversary. And when you watch them in theater, all three of them back to back to back, you really see the dip between part one and two and three.
That's how I remember them anyway.
It's really like, to me, they're all the same quality. And it's only when I saw them in theater, not having a break in between them and just bang, bang, bang. I'm like, wow, the second and third one are really not that good compared to the first one.
This train sequence, or this train chase sequence, I should say, I want to make sure if I really understood what goes on here. So Bond and Tiffany flee in one train cart. Shortly thereafter, it is Serafimo Spang and his boys. They give chase in their own locomotive. And Tiffany explains to Bond that there is a branch track. It's good. The track is going to branch off, and it obviously ends, you know, in the dust, in the amongst the rubble. Bond says, oh, I got a better idea. Let's make Serafimo go on the branch track. I thought Serafino invited people every freaking weekend to party on the train. Does Serafino, like, not know where the branch track is and that it's not going to lead to anywhere? And that his train is going to crash if he goes on the branch track?
Well, it's night. He doesn't see it. And he's chasing and he's going full speed ahead with the train. So even...
And he is shot.
And he's shot. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't be able to break. So
I guess not.
They sabotage. Well, they change.
So I do understand what... I don't know much about trains. So I was wrestling a little bit with this passage. I think I know what they're doing, but I'm not completely sure. So I read that. That is what they're doing.
Yes.
They're tricking the guy who owns this track to go onto the branch track and the train crashes.
He doesn't see it. He doesn't have the time to react. And even if he did... it's like a boat. You're not going to break on a dime. So
no, I understand. Okay, fair enough.
You would
Yeah.
So that's actually a decent trap for something that's improvised. Because their initial goal, I think, is to reach the next town over.
Technically, Las Vegas?
Yeah, it's Rift or Rhyolite. Yeah, they're 50 miles off Rhyolite. And that's where they're trying to reach. That's what they're trying to reach. But
thank God Felix shows up the next morning. Thank God. Yes. Shows up at complete random. Oh, I got a call from somebody, whatever. Here I am. Hi, guys.
Hi, guys. I'm going to take you to the boat.
There's a lot of this. The car ride from Manhattan to Saratoga is another one of those passages. Unfortunately, another one where I'm just like, I don't really care about any of this.
Where he talks about this car, this Dudelac.
That's okay. It's more, I'm thinking more to the passage where he gives Bond something to read, this sports writer who describes Saratoga and what happens in August. And he just keeps on rattling off these names of people that show up and people that have made, not the town grow because it's a tiny little hick town, but in the month of August, it's a really big, important place to be if you're a gangster or if you're a multimillionaire. And I just didn't feel as though this was at least in the novel, we'll get to the film in a moment, but in the novel, I just didn't feel like I was reading a proper Bond film, which sounds like a really petty complaint to make, because you do want Fleming to switch it up every now and then. But he did in the previous movie. Bond didn't globetrot. He stayed in England, and the leading lady was so kick-ass and so hot and so cool that he did, and there were multiple passages in Moonraker that was from Gellibrand's perspective. Mm-hmm. And that happened more than once for extensive periods of time. So he did switch it up. So I have no problem when he switches it up. I want him to switch it up sometimes. I just think switching it up to make it Italian gangster mobsters with diamond smugglers and mud baths is like, this is not the kind of switch up that interests me.
You know, it's an experiment that he's going to try again, if my memory serves right, with Goldfinger, but the villain is better in Goldfinger. Even I remember that, because he technically, Goldfinger is not a spy, he's not a smirch agent, he's just a criminal, but he's more charismatic and his henchman and kills people.
Goldfinger, we don't have that many books to go until Goldfinger. Two books. I'm actually super anxious to read Goldfinger again. That is another one I have not read in a long time, and many, many, many plot details of the book have completely escaped me. I don't remember much of Goldfinger, the book. I'm very excited, but it's the one that inspired, you know, the gold standard of the film. Yeah. So I'm actually really excited to read that one again.
Hopefully you're not disappointed.
We shall see in a couple of months, I guess.
And they take the Queen Elizabeth, which ironically, the cinematic James Bond also visits in The Man with the Golden Gun.
Is that the shipwreck?
Yeah, that's the Queen Elizabeth. I was not too sure. I was like, when I read it in the book, I'm like, wait. Google. Oh, it is!
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. I like that. Yeah. I like that touch. I wonder, I have to assume they knew about that when they made the movie. They're like, this is a little nod to the fans of the book.
Probably,
yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I was happy. And then the sauce béarnaise part kind of made me laugh. But he talks about relationships. And I think, honestly, I don't know what was going on in the Fleming's personal life. I don't think his marriage was very...
It was never an especially happy marriage, yeah. Anyways. But
and you don't... He says you don't add a person, you subtract one. Like, oh, that sounds like somebody's really not happy.
Although it does... Who says that? Is that Tiffany or is that Bond?
That's Bond.
Bond. It does sound like some... Knowing who Bond is, that does sound like something he would say. And as everybody knows, Bond is Ian Fleming. So it's probably what Ian Fleming thought as well.
Also, the Tiffany Case mentioned a gangster called Abadabba.
Yeah.
Otto Biderman, known as Otto Abadabba Berman, was a personal accountant for organized crime. He was killed, I think, around the same time that Dutch Schultz was murdered. That's really like something I know about Dutch Schultz. One of his last words, because he was killed and people have been trying to find his lost gold for at least 70 years. Apparently he had a cache that's hidden somewhere in the Catskills in northern New York.
I got to admit, I'm running out of ideas. I don't have much to say.
I'm just going to go through quickly with my notes. So, okay, let's go for the time in things in the time of Fleming, because I'm going to talk about homosexuality in the time of Fleming, because homosexuality, it was still criminal until 1967, and I'm not kidding.
Wow. Okay.
And it was criminal, like the guy who invented computers. What's his name? They made a movie about him. He had to be chemically castrated, and he killed himself.
Yeah, the Benedict Cumberbatch film.
Yeah. It's messed up.
That's crazy. Knowing that, I actually kind of feel for Mr. Winton, the book. That maybe that's why they want to. Well, they probably want to wear those hoods because they go out and beat the shit out of people, so they don't want to be identified. But I don't know. Maybe there's something else going on there. Where it's like, well, if nobody sees us. If people see us the least possible, we can keep our secret.
You know? He basically calls homosexuals as people with mental problems, but he's not vindictive or angry, because I found out he had a lot of gay friends. Noel Coward, homosexual, gladly living out a life as a homosexual, was neighbors with Fleming in
Jamaica.
Thank you. His estate and Goldeneye they're right next to each other. It's fascinating. If I ever go to Jamaica, I'm going to be able to visit both.
Awesome.
And the guy who did the covers after From Russia with Love until I don't know which book, but he did a few, was actually gay and was one of the first person who registered when they were about to get married. He was one of the first, and he lived. He was born in 1918. He died in 2008. So he lived a long, long life.
It's funny. This is an episode where I've referenced our Live and Let Die, the book episode so much, but I find there are a lot of it echoes that episode and what we talked about. I remember at the start of that episode, we sort of talked about the racism issue and said, well, Fleming was kind of racist, but despite himself, not because he was being mean-spirited or anything. Mm-hmm. He was legitimately curious about this culture. He was, quote, discovering, end quote. And I feel that that does speak a lot to who Ian Fleming was. He was so curious about the world.
It's his journalistic instinct.
Yeah, so I think he was interested in homosexuality. In the back of his mind, probably still thought it was a little bit weird, but not to the extent that he was going to disparage homosexuals overtly to that extent. So there's always that curious balancing act that Fleming does, right? He's describing this in an odd way, but you can tell that he's also legitimately intrigued by it. And that's kind of who Fleming was. He was a 1950s, and he obviously grew up earlier than then, but at the time of these books and his journalism, he was a 1950s stuck-up British guy who really liked learning stuff, even when it was things he thought were super weird. But he still liked learning about them.
Well, there's a part in Casino Royale, the movie, where you see the body exhibit. To me, that's why it felt Fleming-esque, because it's something weird that would have certainly captured his imagination, because it's kind of weird, kind of like on the edge of what's acceptable, because it's dead people. It would have, I'm pretty sure he would have written it in a Bond book had he lived until his very, very old age.
Wouldn't be surprising. So, I mean, I applaud, yes, the descriptions and the way he utilizes those cultures and characters is odd to read. It comes across maybe a little bit questionable when you're reading these in 2018. But I never get the sense that he doesn't hate these things. He wouldn't write about them if he thought they sucked.
Or he would mock them.
He would mock them. But he never mocks anything.
Like, the book has a lot of weak parts, and even though they're not perfect, Winter and Kid are probably the better, some of the better aspects from the book.
I wanted more of them, to be honest. I wanted more of them.
I agree with that. So I'm going to go through the year 1956 very quickly. So January 1956, the Winter Olympics open in Cortina d'Ampezzo in Italy. Does that name sound familiar to you?
Do they Cortina not go there For Your Eyes Only, the film?
Yes, you are correct, sir. Right, you win 1-007.
I'm 001.
Elvis Presley enters the United States music charts the first time with Heartbreak Hotel. You probably heard about Norma Jean Mortensen.
Is that what, Viggo Mortensen's mother?
No, that's legally changed her name to Marilyn Monroe, January 19th.
Oh, good grief. Really?
Yep.
Our dear Marilyn. Good for her.
Videotape is demonstrated at the 1956 NRTB, now NAB. It's a convention in Chicago. A demonstration of a videotape format known as 2 inches quadruplex.
Did they film, record, and then play it back?
Well, I guess that was like, oh, look at this technology we're going to have in the future. Kind of like they did touch.
Remember that conversation we've been having 2 minutes ago? I'm going to show it back to you right now. Oh, my goodness. Oh, maybe. I mean, hey, we're in the 50s. That must have been pretty awesome, actually.
Oh, this is fascinating because it comes up in a Bond novel. And on April 1956, a British diver, Lionel Crabb, working for MI6, dives in Portsmouth Harbor to investigate a visiting Soviet cruiser and vanishes. Does that sound familiar to you if you think about James Bond?
Probably Stromberg's plot in The Spy Who Loved Me?
No, actually, it's it's Thunderball.
What did he do now? He dove in. What happened?
Apparently, he was investigating a Soviet cruiser. And what happened, they found his body. Both hands were cut off. His head was missing. Oof. So they were never like... So it's really weird. There's a lot of conspiracy theory. I recommend that to our listeners, and even you, read about it. It's fascinating. Even to this day. Oh, this is Because I always try to find something about the book in particular. And I heard about this story, the Appalachian meeting. Because before before that meeting, the organized mob, the mafia, was basically, people said, no, it doesn't exist. There's no Casa Nostra. It doesn't exist. But there was a police officer noticed all these nice cars going in what's the name of the little town of Appalachian in New York. It's like, wow, those cars really look fancy. This is Joseph the Joe the Barber, and this is Albert Anastasia. All those gangsters, those famous gangsters, were meeting there. So he kind of like caught a bunch of cops, and they arrested the mobsters, and like they exposed the mafia. Because before that, G. Edgar Hoover said, "No, there's no mafia," and it's they exposed them.
It was just like a local cop.
Yeah,
nice.
It's, I'm probably paraphrasing, but it's fascinating. People,
it's pretty awesome.
Actress Marilyn Monroe and playwright Archer Miller marry in White Plains in New York. She's going to have multiple other marriages. The Lockheed U-2 spy plane it flies over the Soviet Union on July 4th.
It's quite a date for a spy plane to be flying.
Yeah. On October 5th, Cecil B. DeMille's epic "The Ten Commandments," starring Charlton Heston, is released in the United States.
Never seen it.
Saw parts of it.
It's not long.
Oh, and Bob Barker makes his TV debut.
I knew he would. I knew he had been doing that for a while. Yeah, but
Truth or Consequences, December 31st. Now, I don't have that many technically Bond actors. I have a few. Mel Gibson, born on January 3rd, 1956. He was rumored to be a Bond at one point in the 1980s.
Probably the 80s, when he wrote him. Hot stuff.
And Mimi Rogers was born on January 27th. I wrote her in because she was technically in a spoof of James Bond. She's the mother of Vanessa Kensington in Austin Powers.
I haven't watched those in a while, so.
And I put Tom Hanks, because apparently he's a big James Bond fan.
Tom Hanks would be a James Bond fan. I like Tom Hanks. He's a good guy.
He would be good as a villain.
He would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, switch things up a little bit. Stop playing America's favorite personality. Be a bad guy for once.
But no, but that's the thing. That would be kind of like Harrison Ford playing the villain in What Lies Beneath. You don't expect it, and because he's always playing nice guys, good guys, and suddenly he plays this
nice guys.
Well, until then he was always like a hero, but now it's a little bit more scuzzy. But Carrie Fisher, also born. Speaking of Harrison Ford, born on October 21st, 1956. So now we're at the leftovers.
Such enthusiasm.
Well, honestly, Ernie Cornejo, I found him kind of charming. I would actually say he would be a funny sidekick.
Well, I mean, Tiffany Case kind of fulfills that role in the film, I find.
Yeah, I know.
Blow your pants up and stuff like that.
Yeah, but for another movie, whether or not it could take place in another city, but he's just the taxi driver secretly in cahoots with either the CIA or the FBI. It's as covers a taxi driver, and it's really this blobber mouth always talking, hey, Bond, blah, blah, blah. This is the type of character.
They could have made the taxi driver in Live and Let Die that guy.
Yeah.
Hey, Jim. Well, none of the Spang brothers make it into the film, although they're gangsters in the movie, the Spang brothers.
Apparently
don't.
They are. Yeah, apparently in Goldfinger, there's a character called Jack Strap.
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Didn't you see the organigram of the Spangle Mob I sent you?
I recall quite distinctively, for that matter, I recall saying I would take a look at it after reading
you
the
didn't?
Book. Of course I didn't.
Don't worry. I printed it.
I'm sure you did.
The Mudbat. I actually like the Mudbat sequence, but it's in the movie in a bizarre Frankenstein mutant way.
Oh, we'll get to that. I have a few things about that.
And so I have my schematics of the Spangle Mob, because it's apparently they show up again. Apparently Scaramanga worked for the Spangle Mob, and so did one of the gangsters in Goldfinger, whose name is Jack Strap, which is amazing.
Well, Goldfinger is a film where the characters have the most ridiculous names, so why not Jockstrap? There's a much worse name in that movie, so sure, Jockstrap, fine.
Worse, rather tame. Or better.
You know what I mean. It's like it's much tamer. Jockstrap is pretty tame compared to what else we get in that movie.
And then what's funny about the book is that when he catches up back to M, they already know that everything that Bond discovered, so his entire adventure becomes pointless.
And what a weird little ending in Sierra Leone, where he just blows up with a, not a tank, but a sort of motor, jeep, what have you.
Subway.
And the book just ends. The helicopter blows up, and two paragraphs later, the book is over.
Yeah.
Bye. Okay.
Go home.
I think Bond... Actually, oh, hold on, I have the book in front of me here. Just bear with me, listeners. Bond dropped down off the truck and started walking slowly towards the leaping fire. He smiled grimly to himself. All this business about death and diamonds was too solemn. For Bond, it was just the end of another adventure. Another adventure for which a wry phrase of Tiffany Case might be the epitaph. He could see the passionate, ironical mouth saying the words, "It reads better than it lives."
All right, so final summation.
Not Fleming's best work. Remains to be seen if this remains out of the four, it's at the bottom. Will it remain at the bottom? We got a lot of books left to go through, but right now it's at the bottom. Yeah. I don't hate it. I like the Vegas and Spectreville section. You seem to like the Saratoga, New York section. We shared quite a few criticisms about this. But Tiffany Case, not too bad. The Climax, not too bad. And Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd, not too bad either.
No, yeah. It's not too bad. But at the same time, I don't have any strong feelings. When you're not feeling passionate or dispassionate, I wish I hate it. There's movies that I hated with a passion. Books that I found insulting and couldn't finish, or... I wish I had this vitriol for this book, but I don't. It's just like, I don't feel very strongly about it. But if you ask me, should I read it? I'm going to say no, skip it. It's not that important. If you're a big James Bond fan, you've obviously read it before. Whether or not you share the same opinion as we do, it's, I don't want to take the pleasure that you have from this book, whatever it may be. I don't want to argue with you either. That's how I feel. I can't... You can't argue with feelings.
If I'm to recommend some Fleming Bond stories, this won't be at the top of the list. There's easily five or six that I will comfortably suggest before this one. If you die hard and you're really trying to get through all of them, then you will inevitably read Diamonds Are Forever. But if you're not prickly about reading them in order, you could save this one for...
A rainy day.
Yeah, a rainy day. Once you've gotten through your From Russia with Loves and your Goldfingers and your Live and Let Dies and your Moonrakers and your Casino Royales and some short stories, and you haven't read Diamonds Are Forever, okay, fine. You can read Diamonds Are Forever, but you don't need to start with this one.
So my question is for our next episode. Is the book better than the movie, or the movie better than the book? So we'll put that for the end of the next episode. For now... Please, Edgar, tell us where people can find us.
It's quite an extraordinary thing, Matthew. The listeners and the fans can find us in so many wonderful places, such as Twitter. We have a Twitter account, @TheBondComplex. Not .com, just @TheBondComplex, pardon me. We have our Facebook page. We have a website, which is www.thejamesbondcomplex.com. We have an Instagram account. Just search us at James Bond Complex on Instagram. I guess technically we're at anchor.com, but you don't...
Yeah, if you you can subscribe to us on iTunes.
That's probably a little bit more important. Subscribe through iTunes. If you're feeling generous. You may provide a review and a star rating. And if you're feeling particularly generous, we won't complain if you offer a 5-star review. We would be quite pleased with that.
I would like that very much. Thank
you. We're also online individually. I'm at on Twitter, at 00pop, so the word double underscore OH underscore pop. Matthew?
Matt O'Clair. That simple.
Maybe I should have thought of something more simple. I'm always like explaining what my Twitter handle is. Much like James Bond, who always returns, the James Bond complex will return in Diamonds Are Forever, the film, 1971. Merci et à la prochaine.
Bonsoir.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.